Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to somebody who's in the nuclear business. We know that the first nuclear bomb was exploded in Alamogordo, New Mexico. We know it was sort of all put together up in Los Alamos, New Mexico. We also know that in Carlsbad, New Mexico, there is something called the WIP site, which is a waste isolation pilot plant where a lot of nuclear waste is being put into the salt deposits there. They're in a very safe storage. There are other industries that are sort of being spawned by the proximity of those three major features. And one of them is called Urenco. And we're going to be talking today to Gregory Smith. He's the chief operating officer of Urenco. Gregory, welcome to Science Studio.
Well, thank you, Keith. It's a real pleasure for me to participate in your program. I'm excited about it, and I've always been excited about science.
Well, that's great, because that's what we like to sort of start out with. How did a young person like yourself get into the area of science right in the first place? What were those stimulating moments in your early life?
Seventh grade, Dr. Frost. I had a biology teacher in the seventh grade. His name was Dr. Frost. Dr. Frost was your classic nerd. He wore black pants, white shirt, white socks, black horn rim glasses, a shock of white hair. He really was the person that excited me about science. I grew up in Marshall, Texas, and he was just the above and beyond type. We took chicks and injected them with testosterone and saw female chicks grow combs and take on male attributes. He took science for me from the book to the laboratory, and I just became zealous about it.
So, that's actually a beautiful introduction. I mean, did you not get confused about the nature of sex? Seventh grade, you know, you could take a chick and make it into a fellow?
Well, you know, that's what was so magic about it to me. It was really about making magic happen. And we pissed frogs. We did dissection of cats, and in Marshall, Texas, which is a very small town and a small high school, that was just not the normal thing people did in biology classes. They sat down and they read books, and they wrote on laboratories, and they really didn't take what you were reading about they didn't take it and make it alive in the laboratory, and that's what Dr. Frost did for me, and I think that changed my life and my career.
Well, that's wonderful. And did you go on and study biology in college, or did you do something different?
I went to college, and I enrolled in a major that was zoology and chemistry. For the longest time, as I moved my way through college, I thought that I wanted to be a dentist. I got to my junior year in college and realized that I had no interest or desire. I'm just not an office-type person. Working with my hands is not my best attribute, and working in somebody's mouth was something I didn't have a keen interest in. And so my junior year, I realized that that was not the trajectory I wanted to go down, and I started looking for something that when I graduated would excite me, and I was very fortunate in that I was able to get a job with a company called Ecology Audits, and their job was engineering and environmental consulting. And it was an amazing job. Over a period of about 7 years that I worked for Ecology Audits, I visited over 1,500 different types of manufacturing and fabrication facilities, coal mines, uranium mines, nuclear power plants, coal-fired power plants, sugarcane mills in Hawaii, pharmaceutical companies, you name the type of business.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. And this was straight out of college?
Straight out of college. I traveled all the time. And where did you... It was difficult for my personal life because my wife and I were married for a two-year time period. We were married and we never spent more than 2 days in a row together. But it really accelerated my learning. And we're still married.
Oh, good.
It was not detrimental to the point that it would broke up our relationship, but it certainly was powerful from a learning experience and a career perspective.
Well, where did you actually go to school? What university did you study at?
Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas. And graduated with a degree in zoology and a minor in chemistry, and then from there went on to work for ecology audits from 1975 until the early 80s.
And now you're the chief operational officer for Urenco. Tell us, what is Urenco short for, and what basically is the company associated with?
Well, first, a little correction on the title. I'm the president and CEO of Urenco.
Ah.
Yes, I've been promoted since you got my card. So Urenco stands for Uranium Enrichment Company. It is a company that was established 35 years ago. It was established by the three governments of the Netherlands, the Germans, and the UK. And they came together and said, we believe that the enrichment of uranium for peaceful nuclear purposes is important to our countries and the world, but we also believe that our countries need to control the application of this technology. And so they established this company, and the brain behind the company was an individual by the name of Dr. Bernard Zippy. Dr. Zippy was an Austrian scientist that worked on nuclear technology in Germany, actually during World War II. And he was working on enrichment technology using centrifuges for non-peaceful uses. He was actually working on it for the Germans for the application of uranium-235 in a bomb. And the Russians captured him in World War II. They brought him to Russia and held him as a prisoner of war for about 11 to 12 years. And then released him. He developed nuclear technology for them, centrifuges, that the Russians are still using those centrifuges today, primarily for peaceful applications, but there was some use of the uranium-235 that came out of that technology for bomb production.
Well, Gregory, before we go into that, though, why don't you explain what centrifuges have to do with separation of isotopes?
Okay. No problem. So light water reactors use nuclear fuel in the form of uranium-238 and uranium-235 that has been sintered into a pellet and put into a fuel bundle. Natural uranium has 99.3% uranium-238 and 0.7% uranium-235. For it to be usable in a light water reactor, that 0.7% uranium-235 has got to be increased to between 3 and 5%. And that's what business we're in, is increasing that concentration of uranium-235 to around 3 to 5%. And we use centrifuge technology to accomplish that. So a centrifuge is just like what you would have used in your high school biology class. It's something that spins incredibly fast, and it separates out components by causing the heavier components to go to the outside of the centrifuge, the lighter components to go to the inside. And that's basically what our technology is based on, except it's really centrifuges on steroids. Our centrifuges spin incredibly fast, and they are quite large. Our largest centrifuges are over 20 feet tall, and they spin at speeds that are close to the speed of sound.
Wow.
And they spin so fast that they can separate out the uranium isotope 235 from uranium-238. So we introduce uranium in the form of uranium hexafluoride into our centrifuges, and they spin at a speed that causes the uranium-238 to migrate to the outside of this centrifuge and the uranium-235 to migrate to the inside of the centrifuge.
Just to make it clear, we're talking about uranium hexafluoride as a gas. We're not talking about solid materials. We're talking about gaseous particles.
That's right. And the reason why we use uranium hexafluoride instead of just using uranium is hexafluoride is a very unusual compound. It goes from a solid to a gas at a very low temperature. And that temperature is about 133 degrees Fahrenheit. And it goes from a gas to a liquid at a fairly low temperature. That temperature is about 175 degrees Fahrenheit. And so what we do is we take the hexafluoride, we heat it up to above 133 degrees, we introduce it in gaseous form into our centrifuges, and then we produce a product that has increased the concentration of uranium-235 to between 3 and 5%. Once we have that product in our product cylinders, we put it into an autoclave, and we turn it into a liquid form so we can collect a sample and homogenize the product by heating that solid hexafluoride up to 175 degrees. So we go from a solid to a gas. We introduce it into our centrifuges, and then it goes into a cold box where it's cooled back down again, minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit. It instantly goes back to a solid. And then when the product cylinder is full, we put into autoclave and introduce it to a liquid form. Now, the centrifuges, I need to talk about those for a minute. We don't just have one centrifuge. We have tens of thousands of centrifuges, and they're hooked together in a manner so they operate in something called a cascade.
Tens of thousands of 20-foot centrifuges.
That is correct.
That's a lot of feet.
That is what makes this economically feasible. If you just had one centrifuge, it would do the same work, but it would take an inordinate length of time to produce the quantity of product that you would need to fuel a nuclear power plant. So instead, we take centrifuges and hook them together in cascades, or you could think of it as a gang, with each centrifuge performing a part of the work, and over all of these centrifuges producing a product in a much shorter period of time.
And these are all in one central location.
All in one central location. Now, this one central location are these giant buildings. These centrifuges are located in very large buildings, over a football field long. And if you go in the room where these centrifuges are located, the room is full of these tens of thousands of centrifuges all operating together at the same speed. Now, the room is important because they have to be kept at 90 degrees, plus or minus 2 degrees Fahrenheit. The floor has to be perfectly level from one end of this building all the way to the other, within a quarter of a millimeter of the same elevation. The electricity has to be clean that drives these machines. Has to be clean electricity. That means there's very little voltage fluctuation. So a lot of effort goes into making the centrifuges happy that they'll operate at their optimum speed. And there is another thing about these centrifuges that are what I consider amazing. We turn them on, we never turn them off. They require no maintenance, no lubrication, no oil, no grease. We have machines in Europe that have been running for 33 years nonstop, at speeds close to the speed of sound.
Now, that just sounds like science fiction to me, and I'm a scientist. There must be very special materials, then, that you're talking about to make these centrifuges. It's not just the old high school laboratory centrifuge. New materials must be involved to cut down friction, to cut down wear. Can you talk a little bit about the materials that have to be developed?
I've got a box that I have to talk in, because most of what goes on inside a centrifuge is considered secret. It's classified by the United States government and the countries that have a treaty with the United States government. But what I can tell you, it's extremely new technology. It is not your old high school centrifuge.
Well, hang on a minute. No, because you said they've been running for 30 years. Right?
Yes.
Can't be that modern technology.
So the oldest machines we have are the machines in the UK, and they've been operating for over 30 years. We have older machines than that were in Germany and the Netherlands, but we have taken them out of production, not because they weren't capable of continuing to run. It's just that our technology has moved so far so fast that it's no longer economical to run these older machines. And so you're right. 30 years ago, the way we made centrifuges is very different from the way we make it today. The centrifuges have gotten much larger, taller, they operate at faster speeds, and they have different types of material that make up the inside of the centrifuge, but basically the same science is involved.
We must take a break there, Gregory. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and I'm talking to Gregory Smith, who is the president of Urenco in New Mexico, and we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Pain is unavoidable, but having pain daily and all over can drastically limit a person's life.
Many people with fibromyalgia describe this type of crippling pain. It's a mysterious disease that for many years had no known cause or treatment. In fact, it wasn't even officially recognized until 1987.
Since then, we've realized the problem is a malfunction in the central nervous system, specifically in the way the brain and nerves process the signals that cause pain.
Now researchers theorize the cause is a virus called herpes simplex type 1, the same one that causes cold sores.
Based on this hunch, researchers prescribed a drug known to treat herpes simplex type 1 combined with another antiviral drug. They report 90% of patients had improved gastrointestinal, fatigue, anxiety, depression, and fibromyalgia symptoms.
The rationale behind the efficacy of these two drugs is that they attack the virus on several fronts. The virus can become dormant and hide from the immune system and nerve cells, then reactivate and travel within nerves.
The drugs work together to inhibit the active virus from replicating and stop the latent virus from reactivating. Phase 2 of the clinical trials will start in early 2013.
Most fibromyalgia patients are women in their 20s to 50s and complain of gradual, chronic, and widespread musculoskeletal pain, fatigue, anxiety, and depression.
Diagnosis is not easy, so if the clinical trial proves herpes simplex type 1 causes fibromyalgia, it could lead to a new method of diagnosis, which can be a great relief to the 2-4% of Americans who suffer from the disease.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Gregory Smith, the president of Urenco, the uranium enrichment company that's located in this particular case, this particular office, or this branch, should I say, this football field, is in Eunice, New Mexico. Now, it sounds just an amazing concept for anything, a perpetual motion, right? 30 years of operating these giant centrifuges. And so at the end of the line, you know, you go into this football field, you introduce the material at one end, out comes the enrichment at the other. And now you're left, of course, with the unenriched material. Now, you've separated the two. One of these goes to the nuclear power plants, to be diluted a little bit, I suspect, to be used for nuclear generation, energy generation. And the rest of it, what happens to the rest of it?
So and we call that tails. So the tails is that uranium that whose uranium-235 concentration is now no longer 0.7%. When it's 0.7%, it's called natural feed, and that's what we feed into the cascade. Once we run it through the machines, that number can be anywhere from about 0.2 to about 0.4% uranium-235 left in there, and those are tails.
And that's sometimes called depleted uranium, correct?
Depleted uranium, that is correct. Now, some people would consider that a waste. However, in our business, that is not a waste, because then we have other cascades that we have constructed that are what we call refeeders. And a refeeder is constructed so it can take tails material that has a concentration of uranium-235 that is below natural feed, 0.2 to 0.4%, and use that material as a feedstock. And so we refeed that material again through a cascade, and that produces enriched uranium out the other end. And so it's a very interesting process where you produce a material that in most applications would be considered a waste, but in our application, it's still a feedstock. And so we will refeed it through a refeeder unit and strip more of the uranium-235 out until we end up with a tails material eventually that is no longer usable and is considered a residue. Now, what happens with that residue? At the very end, when there's no longer any economic value, what do you do with that material? You deconvert it from uranium hexafluoride back to uranium oxide, which is a metal, a solid material, and then you would dispose of that uranium oxide. There's several different methods of disposal. Now, realistically, what you could do is you could go and put it back in the uranium mine. It's actually less radioactive than what you dug out of the ground in the first place. There are other methods of disposal I happen to be located next to a site. It's called Waste Control Specialist. It's right at our property line, and they are licensed to dispose of this type of material. And what you do is you bury it back in the ground in a container that has been authorized by the United States government to handle this material. It's called a D-70 container, and it has to be stored in a location. It's got a geological formation that will shield it from water for a significant period of time. The reason why the site is located next to us is in a geological formation called the Red Bed. And the Red Bed is a clay formation that's about 65 feet under the surface of where we're located, and it's impervious to water. And as a matter of fact, there is no water in this area. You can drill a well as deep as you want, and you're not going to find water until you get down to about 10,000 feet, and then it's a saltwater formation.
Which,
so
of
that's
course,
the ultimate disposal methodology.
Which brings us to the whole point, which is the fascinating part for me. You're located in Yunis, New Mexico. Now, most people around the world don't know Yunis, New Mexico, and I've been there twice, I think. And I went there a long time ago before your plant was there. And I gather that you produce something like 30% of the uranium-enriched 235 that the United States needs at the current time. Would that be right?
At the current time, that's correct.
Yeah.
Now, we just started construction of our third phase of construction, and that'll get us to 50% of the U.S. requirement.
Okay. So now then that becomes, why on earth is it in Yunis, New Mexico? What is the importance of the climate, the geology, the location of Yunis, New Mexico? Yes.
It now has a population of about 3,000, so it's still not a large place. So what is the first attribute of Yunis, New Mexico that makes it attractive? Well, number one, it's an area of very low seismic activity. Seismic activity is important to us because the centrifuges will not tolerate being shaken around. When you have something that is spinning at these incredible speeds with very little clearance between the rotor that is spinning on the inside and the outside wall, if it gets shaken, then that rotor is going to be destroyed, and about 75% of our investment in this facility would be lost.
And plus, and so there'd be an awful lot of uranium hexafluoride flying all over.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point, and I think is one of the amazing things we've been able to accomplish. We were able to prove that if there were to be an earthquake and it were to destroy the entire site, that the material that is inside the centrifuge, when it disintegrates, actually scrubs the hexafluoride out of the process. And so the release from the centrifuge is actually less than 20% of what was originally assumed when this plant was licensed. And so we have an application in front of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission now to triple the size of the original license of the plant. And even with this plant being triple its original licensed amount, the environmental release is still within what the original assumptions were. If an earthquake were to come, there would be very little release from the site. As a matter of fact, any radioactive material by the time it got to our site boundary would be less than what the regulator calls a non-consequential dose to the public.
Do you live there, Greg, or do you live somewhere else?
No, I live here.
Now, tell me.
I've been in the nuclear industry for over 30 years now.
Right.
I'm usually running nuclear power plants. I've always felt like it's important for the people who run the facility to live in the community.
I agree that entirely. Tell me a little bit about the source of your uranium hexafluoride. Where does it come from? Do you make it on site from uranium native ores, or do you have it shipped in?
It is brought in from one of two locations, either the facility in it's called the Confidine facility in Metropolis, Illinois. They take uranium and convert it to uranium hexafluoride, or the Cameco facility in Port Hope, Ontario, and they take uranium and do the same thing.
So Canada.
That is right. Port Hope, Canada. So, and most of our uranium right now is coming from Canada. Saskatchewan, Canada is the largest uranium-producing location in the world. So most of it comes from there. Some of it does come from Australia. Some of it does come from Kazakhstan. Uranium is a very abundant metal across the world. there is no shortage of uranium, but those two locations are where it is converted for the United States use. Many countries have their fuel fabricated here in the United States just because our quality standards are so high. So there's a lot of use for the uranium hexafluoride other than just for the U.S. nuclear business.
But I remember that up in Grants, New Mexico, there used to be some uranium mines, and they closed down. Is it because the quality of the ore was not good enough, or that, well, what was the reason? I mean, here you are in New Mexico, they have big mines up in Grants, New Mexico, for uranium yellowcake oxide. What's the reason why they aren't being utilized?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I did work in the Grants area back during my environmental consulting days. There's still a lot of ore in Grants, New Mexico. It is certainly there. From an economic basis, it is would still be a very economically viable supply of uranium. And there are companies that are proposing to go back and start mining again in the Grants area. But the bottom line, when they mined in Grants back in the 1960s and 70s, from an environmental perspective, they were not very responsible. And there was a lot of contamination of some of the waterways and things like that. Most of the ore is located on Navajo property, the Navajo Indian Reservation, and they are not presently, they do not find the mining of uranium ore acceptable on their lands. There has been a solution mine that has been permitted in northern New Mexico to go into operation, and that's one of the ways that they mine today. Instead of going in and either doing underground mining or strip mining, actually pump water down to the where the uranium ore body is, and the water dissolves the uranium, and then they pump the water back up to the surface and put it through ion exchange columns.
Okay.
And separate the uranium out that way.
Let me just, but I'm sort of intrigued in the scale of the facility, and with all these hundreds of thousands of centrifuges, that's mind-boggling. The fact that they carry on working forever, 30 years without any oiling or whatever, is amazing. What scale of material comes out? I mean, give the audience an idea at the end, how many tons or how many pounds of enriched uranium was produced?
Well, first of all, remember, uranium has a tremendous amount of energy in a small package.
Right.
And so a product cylinder, it's about 30 inches in diameter. It is about 6.5-7 feet long. Inside that cylinder is about 6,000 pounds or 3 tons of enriched uranium. It takes about 2.5 product cylinders to power a nuclear power plant for 2 years.
Okay.
So you're not talking about a lot of material, but you are talking about a lot of energy.
It's absolutely fascinating technology. I mean, I've got to come out and visit. I mean, just to see these machines and to know that they're going to be working when I'm dead, some of them. I mean, that's pretty grim thought. My body's not as efficient as your centrifuges.
We had the father of the latest technology out here, Dr. Gustav Meyer Kretschmer, about 6 months ago, and I asked Gustav, how long will these machines run? He said, if you could keep all the infrastructure around it operating, you'd come back in 200 years and they'd still be spinning.
Okay, that's made my head spin, Gregory Smith. President Urenco in Eunice, New Mexico. It's been a fascinating talk, and even more so because I just like the way you're so enthusiastic about your own career development and these wonderful machines out there. Thanks so much for being on Science Studio.
Thank you, Keith. It's been a real pleasure.
And thank you, Norma Martinez, for putting it all together, and thank you, the listeners, for being there each week to listen. We'll be back again next week.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. An initiative has kicked off that will result in the creation of a unified identity for the region's life sciences industry. A new coalition called the Life Sciences Communicators will drive the effort. Ultimately, the goal is to distinguish the El Paso Binational Bioplex from other biomedical communities and attract biomedical talent and businesses to the region. Read more at Synapse, the region's Life Sciences News Digest, mcasynapse.org.